Chernovsky's treatise, he called it his book, was passed to Tar Robertson at B1A. If Chernovsky was telling the truth, then he might be useful to the double-cross team. If he was lying, then, like Mathilde Carré, he should be locked up and, if necessary, executed. The decision must be made quickly, since if Chernovsky was to demonstrate his worth to the Germans, he would need to make radio contact as soon as possible. Christopher Harmer was once again tasked with teasing out the motives of a potential double agent and deciding his ultimate fate. Harmer spent days interrogating Chernovsky. The resulting report is a masterpiece of psychology, a remarkable insight into the mind of a spy. Chernovsky was telling the truth, Harmer concluded, but not the whole truth, and only those parts of the truth that suited his purposes. He claimed the Abwehr had recruited him, whereas he had plainly volunteered to spy for it. He insisted he had been acting a part, but the Germans had successfully plied him with propaganda and stroked his vanity. He had come to Britain planning to see which way the winds of war were blowing, and only after assessing the situation had he decided to come clean. "There are considerable doubts about his integrity," wrote Harmer. "It seems possible that he might be embarking on some form of triple cross. But Chernovsky was reliable in one important respect. His loyalty is entirely to his own country, and every problem he sees is bound up with the destiny of the Polish people. He is of an intensely dramatic and egotistical nature. This may be due in some part to his size. It is necessary to avoid taking him at his own valuation. His character, sense of drama, and the feeling of self-importance which his intelligence work has given him, which makes him regard himself in some way as a sort of Joan of Arc of Poland, causes him to dramatize and overrate the part he has played." Harmer tried to imagine what it must have been like for Chernovsky in Fresnes prison, a loyal and fervent Pole in a weak state, physically and mentally, and he reproduced the scene. "As his condition gets lower, so his credibility of propaganda and ideas of grandeur become greater. Their confidence in him grows, and when he suggests that he might also act as a spy for them, they take this suggestion seriously. He himself really thinks that there may be a possibility of fixing up an arrangement between Poland and Germany." But on reaching Britain, Harmer surmised, Chernovsky realized that his German jailers had misrepresented the political situation. He finds that so far from wanting collaboration, the Polish official circles here are determined to continue the fight against Germany. His health and strength and sense of judgment return. He realizes that as a loyal and patriotic Pole, it is impossible for him to carry out his mission. With a dramatic gesture, therefore, he presents his book to his chief. Chernovsky's loyalties depended entirely on what he perceived to be Poland's best interests. "I do not think he is a spy using this story as his cover," wrote Harmer. "There is no evidence nor any probability that he has worked here to the detriment of Britain and for the benefit of her enemies. He had already rendered very great service to this country, and, properly handled, he could do so again. The Germans would have confidence in him, given their hold on him. There is no reason why we should not open up his transmitter. With imagination, and with his very original mind, we might possibly confuse and deceive the Germans to a remarkable extent, but a successful exploitation of the opportunities is dependent on his willing cooperation." Yet again, some senior members of B1A were unconvinced. Marriott, the stickler for rules, pointed out that it had been agreed, "We are never going to tolerate any person who has worked for our service agreeing in any circumstances to work for the Germans." Masterman argued that the Germans have really lost nothing by letting him go, for they have cleaned up the whole of his organization, and the only thing left would have been the doubtful satisfaction of executing him. It seemed possible that the Germans had sent Chernovsky to Britain as a plant, knowing pretty well, certainly, that he would throw in his hand with us. If so, they would know his messages were false from the outset. Were Bleicher and Oskar Reiler simply using the Pole to try to find out what the British wanted the Germans to believe? "We are not yet at all convinced as to his bona fides," Guy Liddell wrote in his diary. The dispute over Chernovsky provoked a blazing row between Masterman, representing the cautious old guard, and Christopher Harmer, the young enthusiast keen to run the Polish spy. Masterman seemed hell-bent on chopping him, thought Harmer, and even intrigued behind my back to do so. The day before his wedding to his secretary, Peggy, Harmer wrote Masterman one of the rudest letters I have ever sent. They later made up. "I loved the old boy," wrote Harmer. "I suppose he was only doing his job of exercising a wise and mature restraint on the irresponsibilities of the hot-headed youngsters." But the hothead stood his ground, insisting they should not throw the case away. Tar Robertson agreed. The Abwehr radio station in Paris had been trying for weeks to make wireless contact. It was decided that Tsarnavsky should begin sending radio messages back to his German controllers, but only on a temporary basis, under close supervision. The Polish authorities, suspicious and resentful, convened a military court of inquiry, which issued a severe reprimand to Tsarnavsky and relegated him to a non-job. Tsarnavsky was delighted with the way matters had turned out. "The new game is beginning," he wrote to Harmer. "The Germans lost the old one. They must lose the new one as well. In my opinion, it is a difficult game, but it might yield enormous advantages, especially during the decisive moments which are drawing nigh." More puffed up than ever, he now set out on the third lap of his extraordinary espionage career, with a new mission and a new name. As a spy in occupied France, he had adopted the codename Valenti, Valentine. As a spy for the Germans, he had become Hubert. And now, as a double agent for the Double Cross team, he was renamed once again. Henceforth, he would be Agent Brutus. The classically educated Harmer came up with this nom de guerre. Roman Tsarnavsky had been turned by the Germans and then returned by us. So I thought, et tu, Brute? Of course, he had carried out a very brave mission in Paris during the first year of occupation, so I thought of Brutus's final speech from Julius Caesar, which begins, "He was the noblest Roman of them all." The words et tu, Brute, are also, of course, the most famous denunciation of treachery in literature, the words of a man who has been stabbed in the back by a friend he trusted. Harmer was convinced that Roman Tsarnavsky, unlike Shakespeare's famous Roman, would not betray him, but his playful choice of codename carried the unmistakable hint of anxiety. 9. The Flock. Agent Cyril, a potential new recruit to the Double Cross team, was not quite what MI5 had been expecting. Elvira de la Fuente Chaudoir was, Harmer later recalled, one of the most elegant women I had ever met. She wore a cloche hat, and as she sat down she peeled off a pair of silk gloves, revealing beautifully varnished nails. For a moment, Christopher Harmer was at a loss for words. She was really very striking. On her return from France, Elvira had been debriefed by MI6, which concluded her mission had been carried out to the best of her ability, and then handed her on to Tar Robertson with the recommendation that she be deployed as a double agent. Harmer's task was to assess her usefulness. He introduced himself as Mr. Palmer, while John Masterman, who sat in on the interview, called himself Masterson. Case officers used, and still use, pseudonyms as close as possible to their own names. That way, if someone happened to use their real name, the person who was not supposed to know it might assume he had misheard. Over the next hour, Elvira told the story of her recruitment in Cannes by a German agent named Bibi, and the deal to furnish political and military information for £100 a month. She made a good impression, thought Harmer. Tar Robertson was cautious. It is by no means clear that she has told us everything she knows. Further investigation into her private life raised the possibility that she might be blackmailed over her lesbian tendencies. For some reason, the word lesbian is frequently capitalized in MI5 files. Perhaps this was the result of a classical education, since the word derives from the name of the island of Lesbos, or perhaps the officers thought such an exotic species deserved special grammatical treatment. She had been reprimanded before for indiscretion, and although she would appear to have learned wisdom, that point will have to be taken into account in considering her employment as a double agent. Her German recruiter was also an unknown quantity. Britain's MI5 had by now amassed a great deal of information about German intelligence personnel. The data was entered onto punch cards and fed into a Hollerith machine, an electrical tabulating apparatus originally invented to process data for the US Census. Elvira's detailed description of Helmut Bleil was run through the device, but disclosed no possible trace. This anxious amateur and alcoholic spy seemed to be operating semi-independently. We have not come across this man before. The most vigorous skeptic was Masterman, who did not want a woman on the team and pointed out that an indiscreet, cash-strapped lesbian with a gambling habit represented a serious security risk. "We ought not to plunge into this case," he wrote. "I cannot help feeling that the Germans would not have given Cyril so much secret ink, etc., unless they had fairly good evidence of her attachment to them. So I am driven back to the fear that she may in fact have deceived SIS. Elvira had made no secret of her interest in money. "She is a rather expensive woman," noted Masterman. "Has she cost SIS a packet?" Harmer won the day. "I think this woman is telling the truth," he insisted. "Bleil regards her as a bona fide agent, and has so represented her to his masters. Her social contacts, as a typical member of the cosmopolitan smart set, would enable her to report all sorts of misleading political and social gossip from the gaming tables and salons of London." Elvira was asked to explain why she wanted to become a double agent. Her answer was revealing. She replied that she had no such desire at all, although she would do it if it was any use. Whatever Masterman's suspicions, she was not motivated solely by money. On October 28, 1942, Elvira was officially brought onto the Double Cross team. Harmer, now her case officer, impressed on her the absolute need for secrecy. She, like Garbo, would be provided with a cover job at the BBC and paid a monthly salary equal to the money she was receiving from the Germans. Under MI5 control, she should begin writing secret letters to Bleil at once. In case of difficulty, she could contact Mr. Palmer at Grosvenor 3171. As a precaution, her letters would be intercepted and her telephone bugged. All she now needed was a suitable new code name, something sophisticated, racy, and intoxicating, as befitted this beautifully manicured spy. "I chose the name of a rum-based cocktail," Harmer later recalled. "The Bronx Martini is usually made with gin, but the barman at the Hyde Park Hotel made a wartime version from rum, orange juice, and sweetened dry vermouth. It was one of the very few cocktails you could buy during the war when gin was in short supply," said Harmer. "It was a very appropriate short name for an exceptional woman." Elvira de la Fuente Chaudoir became Agent Bronx. The little Spanish gentleman who had moved into 35 Crespigny Road, Hendon, was a refugee from Franco's Spain, it was said, who did translation work at the BBC. Every morning, Señor Puyol caught the underground train into central London, and every evening he came back home to his family. He spoke little English and seemed polite, shy, and rather dull. Indeed, the only interesting thing about the new arrivals, from the neighbours' point of view, was the state of their marriage. Their nightly rows in loud and incomprehensible Spanish were a source of considerable entertainment in Crespigny Road. The neighbours would have been surprised to discover that the Puyols were arguing over the finer points of espionage. They would have been even more astonished to learn that, instead of working at the BBC, the little Spanish man spent his days in a small office on German Street, making up an army of fake spies. Juan Puyol possessed what his case officer, Tomás Harris, called a remarkable talent for duplicity. Harris was no slouch in that department, but Agent Garbo was in a league of his own, a master of invention whose entire existence remained wrapped up in the successful continuation of the work. Unlike other double agents, Puyol's absolute loyalty was never questioned. He was, in the best way, an extremist and a fanatic. The pair spent all day at the German Street office, located conveniently close to the Double Cross headquarters, inventing a world of spies, devising stratagems, cooking up new chicken feed, and composing messages. They would break for lunch at Garibaldi's Italian restaurant, and then resume in the afternoon. Their make-believe sessions sometimes extended far into the evening. By the end of 1942, the Garbo network included an airline employee, the courier who supposedly smuggled Garbo's letters to Lisbon, a wealthy Venezuelan student named Carlos, living in Glasgow, his brother in Aberdeen, a Gibraltarian waiter in Chislehurst, whose anti-British feelings were said to be exacerbated because he found the climate in Kent very disagreeable, a senior official in the Spanish section of the Ministry of Information, an anti-Soviet South African, and a Welsh ex-seaman living in Swansea, described by Puyol as a thoroughly undesirable character. The personality, activities, and messages of each spy were carefully imagined, refined, and entered in a logbook. Some of these sub-agents were supposedly conscious collaborators, while others were unwitting sources of secret information. Some were given names, while others remained anonymous. The information they theoretically supplied was written up in secret ink and dispatched inside innocuous letters that the Germans believed were either brought by courier or sent by airmail to various cover addresses in neutral Spain and Portugal. In fact, they were transported in MI6's diplomatic bag. Puyol's sub-agents were able to correspond with the Germans independently after he was authorized to supply them with secret ink. Those agents then began recruiting their own sub-agents. The network began to self-replicate and metastasize until the work of Puyol and Harris came to resemble a limitless, multi-character, ever-expanding novel. The early objective of the Garbo network, in the words of Harris, was to swamp the Germans with information, misinformation, and problems. The information, true and false, was vetted by the 20 Committee. The problems were the fruit of pure creativity. All of it was written up in Puyol's bombastic style. I do not wish to end this letter without sending a Viva Victorioso for our brave troops who fight in Russia, annihilating the Bolshevik beast. If the Germans could be inundated by this deluge of intelligence in as much confusing bulk as possible from myriad fake spies, it would at the very least dissuade them from trying to send over any more genuine ones. The greater the work we caused them to put into the Garbo case, the more they would become conscious of his importance to them. By continually emphasizing the fanatical loyalty, the quixotic temperament, and the untiring energy of Puyol himself, MI5 could make the Germans increasingly dependent on this temperamental genius, who needed to be placated and flattered at all times. They sent money, encouragement, and ever more extravagant expressions of high satisfaction. In response, Juan Puyol threw periodic hissy fits. His tone was that of a testy and demanding lover. Why have I been made to suffer? His complaints were exhaustingly long-winded. I want you to know that if it were not for the esteem which I feel personally for you, which I feel you reciprocate, as well as the interest which I have in helping our cause, for which I have fought for 3 years during our war, and continue to fight for, though in a more responsible position in order to terminate this plague of Reds, I must tell you that in all sincerity and as a friend, that I would have returned to Spain some time ago. The relationship between Puyol and his handler, Karl Erich Kuhlenthal, began to resemble an abusive marriage in which one partner holds the other in abject submission. Puyol battered Kuhlenthal with verbiage. The more we dictated our terms, the more they cooperated. The more arrogant and temperamental Garbo became, the more considerate they were in return. The information provided by the Garbo network was voluminous, but of strictly limited worth. Low-grade military information, political gossip, reflections on public opinion, the occasional item of real deception, and physical evidence when this was requested, such as gas mask crystals sent to Spain inside a tin of Andrew's liver salts. When Garbo did send important real information, this was carefully timed to arrive too late to be of use. It never occurred to Kuhlenthal to wonder why items of little importance, such as gas mask crystals, arrived promptly, whereas the most significant nuggets were invariably delayed in the postal system. It certainly occurred to John Marriott, Robertson's silky deputy, who wondered how the Germans could fail to see their agents as people who seldom or never say anything untrue, but who equally never say anything which is new. The infatuated, dominated partner in any relationship tends to overlook, sometimes willfully, the small clues to infidelity. In German eyes, Garbo's failure to supply high-grade information in a timely way was not his fault, but theirs, and the more often he tried and failed, the more they loved him. One by one, as the flock of double agents fluttered into MI5's coupe, Tar Robertson began to imagine new ways of combating German espionage and using enemy spies to Allied advantage. His thoughts, increasingly, turned to pigeons. For some time, Robertson had been receiving long and detailed reports on the possible uses and actual uses that pigeons can be put to from the point of view of espionage. Pigeons, like lesbians, frequently merited a capital letter. The author of these reports was one Flight Lieutenant Richard Melville Walker, who headed one of the most secret and peculiar units of MI5, the Pigeon Service Special Section B3C, charged with disrupting the enemy's use of pigeons and deploying Allied pigeons for passing on secret intelligence. To describe Flight Lieutenant Walker as a pigeon fancier does not quite do justice to the depth of his passion. He adored pigeons. He lived for pigeons. His reports were long, cooing poems of love. "Years of breeding have made the carrier pigeon into a thoroughbred," he told Tar, "with a magical ability to find its way home over a range of up to 700 miles. Walker wrote about his homing pigeons in the same way that Robertson described his most valued agents. "Out of 100 birds of the same stock, perhaps one will be that bird all breeders hope for, a bird of highly individual character, courageous and resourceful. Much depends on the individual bird, and especially its character and intelligence." Britain had abandoned its military pigeon service after the First World War. But even before the outbreak of the Second World War, Walker had realized that Britain was falling behind Germany in the pigeon race, since these birds remained an important way of passing information across enemy lines, fast, reliable, and virtually impossible to intercept. The Nazis incorporated pigeons into the very heart of the Reich. Each of Germany's 57,000 pigeon fanciers had to have a certificate of political reliability from the Gestapo. Jews were banned from keeping pigeons, and the German Pigeon Federation was placed under the control of the SS. Himmler, who has been a pigeon fancier and enthusiast all his life, has brought his enthusiasm for pigeons into the Gestapo, Walker reported. Eugenics theories were applied to pigeons, and any lofts where the pigeons did not come up to standard were wiped out. In 1937, a pigeon race had been staged in which some 1,400 German pigeons were brought to Britain by plane and then released to fly home. Walker believed the race had been a cover to accustom as many German pigeons as possible to the sea crossing from England to Germany. Walker was convinced that Nazi pigeons were now pouring into Britain by parachute, high-speed motor launch, and U-boat, providing enemy spies in Britain with an undetectable method of sending information to occupied Europe. Walker was not alone in his pigeon paranoia. Basil Thompson, the veteran Scotland Yard spy catcher, observed, "It was positively dangerous to be seen in conversation with a pigeon." Some experts claimed to be able to identify a pigeon with a German accent. With MI5's wholehearted backing, Flight Lieutenant Walker drew up maps of known pigeon lofts in occupied Europe and logged suspicious pigeon sightings. Homing pigeons tend to fly in a telltale straight line, particularly across water. He argued that agents should be sent into occupied territory with a knapsack of pigeons rather than a wireless, since they are easier to work and, once liberated, the agent has nothing incriminating to carry about. Walker began to develop ever more elaborate ways for pigeons to carry secret messages. Small holes burned with a fine nail in the feathers, a tiny roll of rice paper inserted into the hollow part of the main wing feather, messages in Morse code written on the quills in waterproof ink. Evidence of enemy pigeon activity mounted. An exhausted bird dropped onto the Isles of Scilly off the Cornish coast with an intelligence message in French. Two German pigeons were blown across the channel in bad weather, carrying routine training messages. Both birds are now prisoners of war, working hard breeding English pigeons, Walker reported. Flight Lieutenant Walker loved all pigeons, even enemy pigeons, but this was war. It was time to go on the attack. Walker brought in the Falcons. In 1942, the Falconry Unit, comprising three Peregrine Falcons and a Falconer, was established on the Isles of Scilly with the task of intercepting enemy pigeons. It would eventually bring down a total of 23 pigeons, every one of which turned out to be British. These incidents of what might now be called friendly fire did nothing to dampen Walker's enthusiasm. The Falconry Unit proved it could intercept pigeons, he wrote triumphantly. Finally, the birds of prey went AWOL. But by this time, Walker had come up with another ingenious plan. Homing pigeons are sociable creatures, and if a pigeon spots other pigeons flying about, it may join them and, particularly if tired, return with them to their home lofts. This gave Walker an idea. If all the fanciers living within 10 miles of the coast from Cornwall to Norfolk could be organized to form a screen by releasing their birds at staggered intervals, then any enemy pigeon on a homing flight would stand a good chance of coming across these pigeons exercising and would be tempted to join them. Astonishingly, Walker was given permission to carry out the largest military deployment of pigeons ever attempted, a sort of aerial home guard. Walker boasted that the resulting screen covered an area roughly 10 miles deep all along the coast from Land's End to Cromer. It had no effect whatsoever, for the simple reason that the Germans had never attempted to use pigeons to send messages from Britain. Walker did not mind. Had they done so, it is fairly certain that the loft screen would have bagged a fair proportion of them. Walker's pigeon reports received an enthusiastic and supportive reception from Tar Robertson. The idea of using pigeons for deception lodged somewhere in his fertile mind, and would soon take flight. 10. True agent, false agent, double agent. As Brutus and Bronx joined the team, and Garbo and Tricycle spun their webs tighter, it dawned on Tar Robertson that he had built a form of weaponry that could inflict some major damage. Garbo, Puyol, had bewitched the Abwehr in Madrid. Brutus, Chernowsky, had established a brand new channel of communication to the Germans in occupied France, assuming he was not playing some fiendish triple game. Bronx, Elvira Chaudoir, was up and running, writing letters to a mysterious branch of German intelligence, and Tricycle's Popoff hold over the Lisbon branch of the Abwehr seemed even stronger, thanks to the corruption of his case officers. In each case, the German spy handlers were being handled, unknowingly, by the spies. Garbo was running Kulenthal. Brutus was in control of both Bleicher and Reiler. Bronx had Bleil twisted around her elegantly manicured little finger. And Tricycle knew that the greed, ambition, and paranoia of von Kastorf and Kammler had turned his relationship with the Germans 180 degrees. The double agents were now controlling their controllers. The B-1A team would later wonder why it had taken them so long to appreciate the full potential of the double-cross system. Masterman put it down to an obsession with the idea there might be a large body of spies over and above those whom we controlled. By the summer of 1942, Robertson felt reasonably certain that no such body existed. Most secret sources gave no hint that the Abwehr was running any spies other than those already in the double-cross team. By 1942, almost all the traffic of German intelligence services was being read, with over 200 messages decrypted every day. From this trove of information, MI5 constructed a detailed picture of German intelligence and its personnel, methods, strengths, and frailties. MI5 knew who its enemies were and what they were doing and thinking. Indeed, it probably knew more about the Abwehr than the Abwehr did. In July 1942, emboldened and increasingly ambitious for his flock, Tar Robertson made an astonishing claim. He, and not Wilhelm Canaris, controlled the German espionage network in Britain, and as a consequence, he could make Hitler and his generals think what he wanted them to think. The capabilities of this powerful weapon were laid out in a formal memo to the 20 Committee. The only network of agents possessed by the Germans in this country is that which is now under the control of the Security Service, he wrote. The combined general staff in this country have, in MI5 double agents, a powerful means of exercising influence over the OKW, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, the supreme command of the German armed forces. The implications of Robertson's claim were extraordinary. Hitherto, the double-cross organization had been used to catch more spies, extract information on German intentions, seduce the enemy into believing he already had a functioning spy network, spread propaganda, and influence enemy thinking, but only at the margins. After months of passing over chicken feed, true but harmless, there was now an opportunity to distribute information that was methodically misleading and potentially highly destructive. What had begun with the ad hoc interception and turning of enemy agents was developing into a genuine system in which the misleading information from one double agent could be bolstered by all the others, an intricate, self-reinforcing structure that could fill the German files with what we want. From the summer of 1942, the 20 Committee began trying to influence overall German strategy, to burrow into Hitler's thoughts in a way that could cause the Germans massive and perhaps critical damage. It was always in the back of our minds, wrote Masterman, that at some time in the distant future, a great day would come when our agents would be used for a grand and final deception of the enemy. For the moment, caution ruled. Canaris was known to boast about his network of agents in Britain, but the Abwehr was becoming wary. The enemy is becoming increasingly ruthless, and penetration of agent circles is not to be ruled out, warned the Abwehr bosses in Berlin. The interconnected nature of the double-cross system was a source of vulnerability as well as strength. As one German intelligence officer observed, if one pearl is false, the whole string is false. It would take just one mistake or betrayal to reveal to the Germans that not one, not a few, not even most, but all their agents were false. In that case, rather than Britain's high command shaping German thinking, Hitler would know exactly what falsehoods the British were trying to feed him and change his plans accordingly. For all his boldness, Robertson was haunted by the knowledge that if one of his double agents was really a triple agent, then far from unveiling a war-changing new weapon, he could be leading the Allies toward disaster. It is always impossible to be certain in such cases whether the Germans are fooling us or we are fooling them, he reflected. Gisela Ashley, B1A's expert on the German mentality, sought to reassure him, insisting that while the Nazis are very good double-crossers, they lacked the patience and guile to set up a carefully and cleverly worked-out system of deception. The very few really important agents, it was agreed, should be held in readiness for a large-scale deception which could, at a crucial moment, be of paramount operational importance. This glittering possibility, as Masterman put it, was some way off, but it could be glimpsed in the distance. And it was brought an enormous step closer by the appointment, as Britain's chief deceiver, of a man with the most highly polished shoes in the British Army. Colonel J. H. Bevan, the newest member of the 20 Committee, was a straight-laced, cricket-playing, workaholic stockbroker of rare intelligence and impeccable attire. Johnny Bevan tended to judge others by appearances, taking particular exception to slovenly uniform. But there was probably no one in the British military establishment more acutely aware that appearances can be deceptive. From May 1942, he headed the London Controlling Section, known as LCS, with orders from Winston Churchill to prepare deception plans on a worldwide basis and put in train any matter calculated to mystify or mislead the enemy. As controlling officer, Bevan would become the mastermind of wartime deception, overseeing a worldwide web of deceit and mystification from the underground warren beneath Whitehall known as the Cabinet War Rooms. In September 1942, Bevan was inducted into the arcane world of Double Cross. For the rest of the war, the double agents, no longer an exotic sideshow, would be fully integrated into military operations. We had an instrument which had been tried and tested, and which we could offer to the controlling officer for his deception plans, wrote Masterman. Bevan played this instrument like a virtuoso. The initial test of Tarr's claim came with Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa in November 1942, the first great Allied amphibious offensive of the war. Bevan drew up a deception plan aimed at misleading the Germans into thinking the Allies intended to attack northern France and Norway, while simultaneously attempting to relieve Malta. Among the double agents used to put across the deception were the two Norwegians, Mutt and Jeff, Tricycle's sub-agents, Balloon and Gelatin, and Tate. But the main burden fell on Garbo and his fictional network. He and his agents reported troops massing in Scotland, apparently poised to attack Norway, preparations for a fictional cross-channel assault, and numerous other tidbits that, when assembled, would encourage the Germans to tie down troops far from the real point of attack. At the very least, they would sow confusion. Some of Garbo's fake agents, it transpired, were simply too well placed for their own good. William Gerbers was a German-Swiss businessman living in Liverpool, who had been conjured into being by Garbo before he even arrived in Britain. Ships and troops were massing in the Mersey for the invasion of North Africa. Gerbers, had he existed, would surely have seen them there. How to explain that this active agent had failed to report such an obvious prelude to invasion? The solution was simple and brutal. Gerbers was first rendered extremely ill with a lingering malady and then put to death. MI5 even inserted a death notice in the Liverpool Echo, which Puyol clipped out and sent to his handlers. The Germans sent a letter of condolence. To maintain his growing reputation, however, Garbo needed to demonstrate access to high-grade material. He therefore sent two letters, both containing correct information. The first accurately reported a convoy leaving the Clyde on October 29th. I fulfill my duty by advising you of this danger. The second relayed information obtained through the Ministry of Information, indicating an imminent invasion of French North Africa. The B1A team contrived to ensure that these arrived in Spain on the eve of the invasion, too late to be of any use. The Germans were wholly unprepared when Allied forces landed at Casablanca, Algiers, and Oran in early November. Puyol's handlers were pleased, nonetheless, by the evidence of his loyalty and efficiency, even if the postal system had stymied his efforts. Your last reports are all magnificent, but we are sorry they arrived late, especially those relating to the Anglo-Yankee embarkation in North Africa. Bevan was promptly promoted, but Masterman was too hard-eyed a realist to claim credit for the double-cross team. The success was not primarily a triumph for deception, and still less for the double-agent system. The Germans seemed, in fact, to have fooled themselves into thinking that the Allies lacked sufficient shipping for such an invasion. The system might not yet be powerful enough to make the enemy believe a false plan, but it had helped disguise the real plan. Here was an exhilarating foretaste of what the spies might be able to achieve in the future. With the eye of a successful coach, Masterman looked back on the season with satisfaction. By the end of 1942, the team was distinctly stronger, he wrote. Some impressive new players were stepping up to the crease, in the shape of Bronx and Brutus. Garbo was piling on the runs. Tricycle was back in the squad. But cricket and espionage are games of patience as well as skill. If the agents were ever to have their big day in the future, they had to be built up and maintained, so that at the right moment we could be sure that we had a team of trusted agents who would be ready when called upon. The players, Masterman knew, are only the most visible parts of a successful team. Winning also depends on the trainers, the specialist advisors, the backroom staff. The double agents were a mixed, even a motley crew, but the men and women who ran the double-cross team were, in some ways, even odder. Tarr Robertson deliberately gathered around him people who were out of the ordinary. Their very strangeness set them apart from the herd, reinforcing secrecy but also a sense of exclusive camaraderie that a more conventional unit would never have achieved. There was John Masterman, dry and deliberate, an older, wiser statesman to stop the inexperienced young hotheads from doing something totally irresponsible. Masterman could be guaranteed to argue each side of an issue with total logic and lucidity, and then come down with a dull thud on the side of the status quo. John Marriott, the sharp-tongued Cambridge-educated solicitor, who did little to disguise his opinion that double agents were only one step removed from crooks, and that a short one. Tommy Harris, the extrovert art dealer. Billy Luke, the pleasure-loving industrialist. Cyril Mills, from the world of the circus. And Hugh Astor, the scion of a newspaper dynasty. Each had been diverted from a more orthodox military path. Christopher Harmer was almost blind in one eye, and therefore precluded from advancement in the service. Childhood polio had left Astor with a permanent limp. Ian Wilson could handle humanity brilliantly on paper, but found personal conversation almost impossible. Gisella Ashley would have made a fine military officer, had she not had the misfortune to be a woman. Ewan Montague was too old for frontline action, and Masterman was troubled by guilt because he had been interned in Germany during the First World War, and had missed the action and sacrifice that claimed so many of his contemporaries. Unable to do battle physically, they compensated by devoting their talents to a form of intellectual warfare. From behind their desks, these men and women fought a specialized conflict without any training whatsoever, using language, ideas, and information as others fought with guns and bombs. It was the indefatigable Gisella Ashley who urged the team to come up with ever more extravagant forms of deception, and never to underestimate the literalness of the German mind. What may appeal to an Englishman, even an Englishman engaged in double-crossing, as absurd, unlikely, or naive, may be the very thing that a typical Nazi would swallow and do. Just as the double agents lived double lives, so each officer had to try to inhabit the life of his agent. "The case officer had to identify himself with his case," wrote Masterman. "He had to see with the eyes and hear with the ears of his agent. He had to suffer himself the nervous prostrations which might follow an unusually dangerous piece of espionage. He had to rejoice with his whole heart at the praise bestowed by the Germans for a successful stroke. More than that, the case officers had to imagine themselves into the lives of their German opposite numbers, after the most careful psychological study." Through Elvira Chaudois's letters, Hugh Astor sought to understand what made Helmut Bleyl, her German handler, tick. Ian Wilson found himself trying to fathom the corrupt and charming Ludovico von Karstorff. Tommy Harris began to feel something like kinship with Karl Erich Kuhlenthal, whose eager gullibility was the key to Garbo's fictional world. These were intimate enemies. Handling such fissile human material, for such high stakes, was an emotionally demanding and highly stressful business. "We were playing with dynamite," said Masterman. Some, like Wilson, drank too much pink gin to alleviate the strain. Everyone smoked, all the time. Yet there was also a unique brand of merriment in the cramped and smoky rooms of St. James's Street, a sense that their shared mission was not only important, but occasionally fun and frequently absurd. Gisella Ashley found herself stumped, in a message to Popoff, by a reference to the gonorrhea expert without hairs. Who could the Germans be alluding to? Popoff himself was, miraculously, free of VD. "This might be a heavily jocular reference to Johnny Jepsen," Wilson suggested, with convoluted delicacy. "What we know of his habits makes the suggested description not entirely inapt. The hair on his head is described as thick, but the reference may not be to his head. This was, truly, a strange war." Much of the work was done on paper, with the careful gathering and sifting of material, the drafting and redrafting of messages. The double-cross system was, in part, a triumph of filing. Masterman insisted that only a well-kept record can save the agent from blunders which may blow him, or inconsistencies which may create suspicion. The B1A files grew to a truly formidable size, each one indexed and cross-referenced, since the messages of any one agent had to be consistent with the messages sent by him at an earlier date, and not inconsistent with the messages of other agents. The evidence on enemy intelligence officers and agents grew to more than 20 volumes, a veritable who's who of German spying. The Garbo case alone would swell to 21 files, more than a million pieces of paper, The Germans continued to send over spies, though in dwindling number, since the existing ones were doing such a good job. Joseph Terradellas, a Catalan separatist who was turned to become Agent Lipstick. Valdemar Janowski, a German landed by U-boat in Canada who was run jointly with Royal Canadian Mounted Police and MI5. The most remarkable new arrival was Eddie Chapman, the British safecracker parachuted into East Anglia in December 1942, who would become Agent Zigzag. Each fresh arrival, each intercepted spy, each potential new double agent added to the strength of the system and the mountain of paper. With some trepidation, it was decided to introduce Winston Churchill to the Double Cross story. The hesitation did not spring from any sense that the Prime Minister was uninterested in spies. Quite the reverse. He was fascinated by the deception and would look back on wartime espionage with glee. Tangle within tangle, plot and counterplot, ruse and treachery, cross and double cross, true agent, false agent, double agent, gold and steel. The bomb, the dagger, and the firing party were interwoven in many a texture, so intricate as to be incredible and yet true. In fact, Churchill was far too interested in the delicate business of espionage, and there was a danger he might interfere. The 20 Committee was unofficially approved by Churchill, but not subject to ministerial responsibility. That way, the committee could not claim to have been authorized to do what they were doing, much of which was, strictly speaking, illegal. Today this would be called plausible deniability. The arrangement gave the Double Cross team unusual freedom, and it kept Churchill at arm's length. When it was first proposed that the Prime Minister should be informed of what was actually going on, Guy Liddell, the head of B section, feared that he might, on seeing some particular item, go off the deep end and want to take action, which will be disastrous to the work in hand. But by the beginning of 1943, the system was running so well, its potential so great, and its substance so certain to appeal to Churchill's vivid imagination, that it was agreed to introduce him to the cast and the drama, a little at a time. The first monthly report to Winston Churchill, in March 1943, offered an espionage inventory. In all, 126 spies have fallen into our hands. Of these, 24 have been found amenable and are now being used as double-cross agents. In addition, 12 real and 7 imaginary persons have been foisted upon the enemy as double-cross spies. 13 spies have been executed. The report described Garbo, Zigzag, and Mutt and Jeff, who had just received a wireless, £200 in notes, and sabotage equipment via parachute in a remote Scottish glen. Churchill was riveted. Across the report he scrawled, "Deeply interesting." In time he would be introduced to Tricycle, Brutus, and Bronx. The reports were drafted by Anthony Blunt, who drew up a long version that was then boiled down for the Prime Minister. Agent Tony also passed the information to his Soviet handlers. Stalin was fully versed in the double-cross system. Indeed, as Christopher Andrew, the authorized historian of MI5, writes, the Soviet leader may well have seen more detailed reports than Churchill. The Prime Minister's marginalia showed why it had been wise not to get him too involved too early. When informed that a clerk at the Portuguese embassy was spying for both the Germans and the Italians, he wrote, "Why don't you shoot him?" But Churchill did not go off the deep end. Instead, he was gradually immersed in the story, the strange tale of cross and double cross, true agent, false agent, double agent. Elvira Chaudois was shaping up to be a very competent letter-writing agent, reported Masterman. The tap on her telephone had produced no evidence of any pro-German sentiments, and was maintained merely to keep an eye on her financial position. This was, as usual, dire. Unpaid bills from various nightclubs showed that Elvira was enjoying her return to London's high spots. She plays bridge or poker every night, principally at the Hamilton Club or Crockford's, obviously for high stakes, her MI5 minder reported. She is not engaged in any sinister activity, although he added, it is not known whether she is continuing in her lesbian tendencies. She was. Under the watchful eye of Hugh Astor, she began sending letters in secret ink to Helmut Bleyl, care of Banco Espirito Santo in Lisbon and the Hotel de Paris in Monte Carlo. The cover letters consisted of completely meaningless feminine chat, according to Astor. This text is so much in her own style, which is very far removed from anything I could produce, that in my opinion any attempt to interfere with it would be liable to show that the text was written under control. Between the lines, writing in capital letters with a matchstick dipped in secret ink, she began to record items that might be of interest to Bleyl. Initially, her observations were banal. "Last week I saw a man unloading a lorry full of foodstuffs into an old empty house next to the church at Roehampton." But as she grew more confident, she and Astor began to insert half-truths, rumours, elements of propaganda, and harmless military details. "Her friends are to be found in any of the smart bridge clubs in London," wrote Astor, "and, as a friend of several English socialites, she has been in a position to pick up much indiscreet gossip from government circles. Among her acquaintance were aristocrats such as Lord Carnarvon, the Duke of Marlborough, Duff Cooper, head of the security executive, and a number of senior military officers." In addition to reporting items of interest she had really heard, with Astor's guidance, Elvira made up additional snippets and attributed them to individuals she might plausibly claim to have met, including Churchill's son-in-law and the chairman of a war cabinet committee, Duncan Sandys, and the press barons Lords Beaverbrook and Kelmsley. As ever, MI5 had no scruples about putting words in the mouths of real people. "We took great care to make every detail as authentic as possible," Astor later recalled. "I'm afraid we took the names of a good many people in vain. We certainly suggested that the former war minister, Oliver Stanley, and peers such as Lord Lovett and Lord Mountbatten were among her circle of friends. Of course, they had no idea Bronx was attributing some splendid indiscretions to them. If they'd known, they'd have been furious." To supplement her income, Elvira wrote vigorously anti-Nazi articles for the British popular press, for which she apologized to Bleyl in her secret letters. "I hope you won't mind reading my article in Sunday Graphic, as it was essential that I should get the reputation for hating Germany." The sum of £100 soon landed in her Swiss bank account, the first monthly payment from the Germans. It was a drop in the ocean of her debts. Harmer advised the MI5 accountants to be generous. "As she is a woman with expensive tastes, we would come off better if we allowed her to keep what the Germans sent her." The deposits to her account arrived with satisfactory regularity, but they were always minus several hundred pounds, suggesting that somebody on their side is taking a rake off. This fresh evidence of corruption planted the seed of an idea. Bronx sent a letter suggesting that Bleyl or his associates should send her a large sum of money that she could invest, on their behalf, on the British Stock Exchange. It was hoped that an unscrupulous member of the Abwehr might see in this an opportunity of getting capital out of Germany and creating a nest egg for after the war. The money, of course, would be appropriated, enabling the case to become self-financing and solving her money problems. Elvira, needless to say, was enthusiastic about the plan and extremely cross when her German handlers ignored this suggestion. The Germans might be gullible, but they were not so foolish as to employ a woman with a gambling habit as a secret stockbroker. Initially, Elvira's reports consisted of economic morsels. As time went on, her range widened to include reports on political and military affairs. Her letters were a strange, almost surreal mixture of the mundane, the personal, and the important. "Tank production retarded by lack of tracks," she reported. "Heavily in debt. Canadian invasion practices in Scotland. Increased number of American troops in London. Shortage of kitchen utensils." She insisted on swift and regular payments. "Money must be sent at the beginning of month. Serious risk and no claims for expenses." When the Germans asked for information on gas warfare defences, she gave a glowing account of the excellence of British preparations and pointed out that the British had developed large stockpiles of chemical weapons to retaliate if the Germans resorted to a gas attack. Masterman believed her report had helped to dissuade the Germans from mounting a gas attack, possibly saving many lives, and proving that we can in some instances influence and perhaps change the operational intentions of the enemy. The only fly in the ointment sat in the Secret Intelligence Service next door. Claude Danzy, deputy chief of MI6, took every opportunity to poison his protégé's mind against MI5, telling her that she was being grossly underpaid. He has apparently said that he did not think we were working along the right lines, Astor reported through gritted teeth. It is interesting to note that the case is being supervised by Danzy in this indirect manner. Interesting and extremely annoying. A formal complaint was lodged, which only encouraged Danzy to redouble his interference. MI5 began to wonder whether it was Blyle, or someone pretending to be him, who replied with letters in secret ink, praising her work. We have no knowledge of which section is running Bronx, or who are the officers in control of her case, wrote Astor. Even so, references to a female agent, a member of the International Smart Gambling Set, began to appear in most secret sources, indicating satisfaction at a high level with this new spy at the heart of the British social scene. Bronx is believed to be a reliable agent, Astor recorded. It may be, of course, that Blyle or the officers running her know or assume that she is under control, but there is every reason to believe that the HQ at Berlin are led to believe that she is a reliable agent. 6 months after her return to Britain, Elvira was given a formal seal of approval. The evidence suggests that the Germans believe in Bronx. The clouds of doubt surrounding Agent Brutus took longer to disperse. The radio technicians of B1A constructed a wireless using the crystals he had brought from France, and under close supervision, Roman Chernavsky made his first radio contact with Paris shortly before Christmas 1942. The enthusiastic response from Oskar Eiler, his German handler, suggested he had complete confidence in his agent. The same could not be said of the British, who still wondered whether the Germans had sent him to the UK knowing he would switch sides. They had studied him from the psychological standpoint, Masterman observed. If they convinced themselves that he had thrown them over, his traffic from this country could be a source of great danger to us, since they would read his messages in reverse. If, for example, he passed on evidence of an attack on Denmark, then the Germans, knowing he was controlled, would conclude that Denmark was safe. The 20 Committee ruled that Brutus should be run sparingly and not used for operational deception. He would be allowed to lead a free and normal life, but under close scrutiny. His telephone bugged and his mail opened. The Polish Intelligence Service also put him under surveillance. One false move, and he would be joining Mathilde Carré in prison. Chernavsky was eagerly cooperative and happily resumed a life of full-time espionage. Unlike so many of the spies sent to Britain, Brutus was a professional military observer. His first reports gave details of the Polish armed forces in Britain, which the Germans already knew, and political attitudes within the Polish community. After a month, he visited Scotland and sent a description of military deployments in the north that the Germans hailed as exceedingly good. This was followed by a lengthy report on the south coast. These field trips followed a pattern. Chernavsky, accompanied by his case officer, initially Harmer and later Astor, would tour a given area and then draw up his genuine observations and discoveries, complete with maps, insignia, and even the identities of individual commanding officers. Much of this information was far too important to be passed on to the Germans. The 20 Committee would whittle it down and add new touches, which Chernavsky would translate into his own distinctive telegraph French. Sometimes he operated the wireless himself. At others, he was mimicked by one of B1A's radio operators. Brutus is very easy to imitate, because he is a very bad operator and commits very distinctive faults. His messages to Colonel Geiler were larded with self-praise. Several of my old agents, who work in this country, are very discontented on account of their treatment at the hands of the British. They are still bound to me by intense personal loyalty and will work for me without question. Chernavsky continued to behave as if the destiny of Poland lay in his hands, insisting he would continue to spy for Germany only if I have your government's undertaking, after the defeat of the Allies, to offer through me to the Polish government liberal peace terms. There were moments of high anxiety. Whoever was operating the transmitter at the German end sometimes tried to trip him up, to test if Czernowski was really the recipient. Every now and then they'd send us a trick question. What is the name of your mother-in-law? When was she born? Astor noticed that when Czernowski was operating the transmitter himself, he spelled London in the French way, Londres, but he left off the S. Could this be his control signal, the distinctive mistake, to alert his German masters that he was operating under British control? Astor casually asked him to address a handful of envelopes to London addresses. It soon became apparent that Czernowski simply couldn't spell. Gradually, the fear that Czernowski was working with the Germans ebbed. Almost certainly, Brutus did not have a triple-cross mission, wrote Harmer. His position as a German agent is clear. Namely, he is working for us. The secondary anxiety, that the Germans might suspect he was working for the British, lingered longer. 3 months after the first radio transmission, Robertson was still feeling a little anxious about Brutus, keen to use him in active deception, but worried that in so doing the British might warn the Germans instead of deceiving them. He wanted evidence that he is fully trusted by the Germans, in which case he would be eligible for use in deception. Most secret sources duly obliged, revealing that Abwehr reports on Agent Hubert contained no qualification to suggest that the source was not a genuine one. Berlin described him as a very valuable wireless agent. Brutus was becoming a trusted source of military intelligence. As confidence grew both in him and in the Germans' belief in him, he was used more and more. While Czernowski's stock rose with both his British and German spymasters, it plunged to new lows within the Polish government in exile. He threw his weight about and gave himself airs, and was at loggerheads with all the other officers. Harmer had grown fond of this bull-headed Pole, but had to concede that he is a vain and conceited man who spent a considerable period of the war in exciting activities and now found himself doing a largely academic job. Colonel Gano, the head of Polish intelligence, wanted this infernal nuisance sent on a mission to Persia to get him out of the way. He spends his whole time making very damaging criticisms of other people's work and is inordinately ambitious, prying into everything. Within weeks of arriving in Britain, he was embroiled in Polish politics, which, as in many small and unhappy expatriate communities, were deeply rancorous. Czernowski espoused extreme anti-Bolshevism, lecturing anyone and everyone of the iniquities of the Soviet regime. He was a pathological plotter, reflected Harmer, and dreamed of setting up a new network, this time to mislead the Germans. He suggested that he recruit his lover Monique as a sub-agent. Harmer firmly told him to do nothing of the sort, and sensed that he was hurt. Restless, troublesome, and self-important, Czernowski needed another outlet for his boundless capacity for intrigue. He soon found one, with calamitous results. To mark the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Red Army, General Stanislaw Ujewski, Inspector General of the Polish Air Force, attended a reception at the Soviet embassy in London. Anti-Soviet feeling was running high among Polish expatriates after the Katyn massacre, in which thousands of Polish officers had been murdered on Stalin's orders. Czernowski was outraged by what he saw as Ujewski's cozying up to a murderous regime. In early June, he wrote a blistering attack on the general entitled In Defense of Our Colleagues, ran off hundreds of copies, and distributed them throughout London. His denunciation was written in pungent style, littered with exclamation marks, and calculated to cause maximum offence, which it did. The Soviets committed terrible crimes against the Poles. These Red soldiers ill-treated Polish women and bestially murdered thousands of our defenceless colleagues. It is unworthy for the head of the Polish Air Force to go to a tea party where they danced on the newly made graves of many Polish soldiers. Ujewski was attacked as an overpaid, immoral, flattering coward who should be sacked, The Polish Air Force deserves a better leader. This was a resounding political polemic. It was also an act of mutiny. Within hours of distributing his pamphlet, Czernawski was arrested by the Metropolitan Police Special Branch at the request of the Polish government and charged with the gravest military indiscipline. His flat was searched, and Czernawski was imprisoned in Scotland to await court-martial. His enemies in Polish intelligence rejoiced that the little tin-pot hero was getting his comeuppance. Christopher Harmer and Tar Robertson were appalled. Just as Brutus was developing into a first-class double agent, he had brought matters to a screeching halt and now threatened the extinction of the case. Harmer rushed to his prison cell and found Czernawski quite unrepentant, declaring pompously that any patriotic Pole would have done likewise. When Harmer ticked him off for meddling in affairs which were not within his province, Czernawski insisted it was the duty of someone to expose this, and he was the only person in a position to do so. He seemed to be relishing the attention, and positively proud of stirring up a hornet's nest. From his cell he wrote letters to Monique, which demonstrate a desire to dramatize himself and his life, and a capacity for exhibitionism which almost shows the first signs of delusions of grandeur. If Czernawski's radio suddenly fell silent, the Germans would assume he had been caught. A message mimicking Brutus's wireless style was immediately sent to Paris, reporting that he and other anti-Bolshevik Poles were suspected of distributing anti-Soviet propaganda. I foresee my arrest as very probable. I am hoping for the best, but the situation is very dangerous. 2 weeks later, he sent another message. 20th June, arrested in the clandestine anti-Russian affair. Detained in Scotland. Await trial. Foresee light punishment. Fear I am being watched at present. Until the end of the trial, too dangerous to transmit. I regret difficulties. Morale good, am hopeful. This would explain his absence from the airwaves and was sufficiently near the truth to be plausible if the Germans got wind of his arrest. Whether they would actually believe him was another matter entirely. Harmer was gloomy and doubted whether the Germans will ever accept Brutus as 100% reliable. Awaiting trial on charges of indiscipline and offensiveness to superior officers, Czernawski suffered a brief moment of contrition and apologized for the harm he had done to the great game. His career as a double agent was over, at least for now. Brutus had managed to stab himself in the back. 11. Cockade. Garbo's network grew more and more elaborate as new fictitious spies were added to his roster. The widow of Wilhelm Gerbers, the spy killed off in Liverpool, stepped in to take his place. Agent Dagobert, the undesirable Swansea seaman, began recruiting his own sub-agents, eventually assembling a team of seven. Most important, Garbo enrolled a radio operator. Letters in secret ink were slow and cumbersome. A wireless link would speed up communication with Madrid. Garbo told his German handlers that the Gibraltarian waiter, Fred, had found a friend, a Spanish Republican with a wireless set he was prepared to operate on Puyol's behalf. In reality, the set was operated by Charles Haynes, a former Lloyds bank clerk and amateur radio ham now in the Intelligence Corps field security section. The Germans provided Puyol with a code, which Little described as perhaps the highest-grade cipher ever used by the Abwehr. The volume and speed of the Garbo traffic increased exponentially. The one-man band of Lisbon developed an orchestra which played a more and more ambitious program, wrote Masterman. A report to Churchill sang the Spaniards' praises. Garbo himself works on average from 6 to 8 hours a day, drafting secret letters, enciphering, composing cover texts, writing them and planning for the future. Fortunately, he has a facile and lurid style, great ingenuity and a passionate and quixotic zeal for his task. Everyone, it seemed, was pleased with Juan Puyol, except Mrs. Puyol, for while his secret life flourished, his domestic life was floundering. Araceli Puyol was lonely, homesick, and fractious. She was banned from contact with London's Spanish community, lest she let something slip. She spoke no English, had no friends, and seldom left the house in Crespigny Road. Tommy Harris disliked Mrs. G, describing Araceli as a hysterical, spoilt, and selfish woman, but her complaints were not unreasonable. Her husband was up at dawn and worked late. When he finally came home to Hendon, he was exhausted and irritable. She was expected to cook, clean, and look after their son. She threatened to leave him, but had nowhere to go. The house at 35 Crespigny Road echoed with the sound of raised Spanish voices and breaking crockery. The Puyols' relationship was under the sort of strain familiar to many marriages, the only difference being that their domestic disharmony represented a direct threat to the Double Cross project. Juan Puyol was not the only man to use winning the war as an excuse for neglecting his wife, but in his case, it happened to be true. Araceli first asked, then pleaded, and finally demanded to be allowed to return to Spain, if only for a week. Harris was coldly unsympathetic, suggesting she was unbalanced. Araceli snapped. On June 21, 1942, she telephoned Harris and threatened to destroy the entire Garbo network by revealing his activities to the Spanish diplomatic authorities. "I am telling you for the last time that if at this time tomorrow you haven't got me my papers ready for me to leave this country immediately, because I don't want to live another 5 minutes longer with my husband, I will go to the Spanish embassy. I shall have the satisfaction that I have spoiled everything. Do you understand? I don't want to live another day in England." Harris certainly did understand. Araceli had to be stopped. He arranged for the Spanish embassy to be put under surveillance, so she could be arrested if she appeared there. He also considered warning the Spanish embassy that a woman of Mrs. G's description is anxious to assassinate the ambassador, which would ensure her being flung out if she attempted to go to the embassy. Little thought it might be best to lock her up. Robertson wondered whether to go to Crespigny Road himself and read her the riot act. Even Churchill was informed of the outburst of jealousy from Mrs. Garbo and her threat to ruin the whole undertaking. But it was Puyol himself who came up with a drastic plan to subdue his wife by subterfuge. The next day, a special branch officer arrived at number 35 and told Araceli that her husband was under arrest and that he needed to collect his toothbrush and pajamas. Juan Puyol had tried to quit as a double agent, the officer explained, because she had threatened to give the whole show away. The belief that she had caused her husband's arrest produced a hysterical outburst from Araceli. She telephoned Harris in floods of tears and insisted that her husband had always been loyal to this country and would willingly sacrifice his life for our cause. Later that day, she was found by Charles Haynes in the kitchen, which was filled with fumes from the gas oven, an apparent suicide bid, which Harris coldly dismissed as 90% play-acting. Weeping and distraught, poor Araceli's capitulation was complete. She pleaded that it was she who had been at fault, and that if her husband could be pardoned, she promised she would never again interfere with his work, or behave badly, or ask to return to Spain. Puyol's plan had been brutal, effective, and revealing. Beneath his gentle manner, he was absolutely dedicated and quite ruthless, prepared to go to extreme lengths to preserve the network he had created, even if that meant double-crossing his own wife. Dushko Popov, as ever, was living in considerable comfort. He moved into Clock House, a charming cottage in Knightsbridge, which he rented for 12 guineas a week, and recommenced his affair with, among others, Gwenny, whose passionate missives were intercepted and copied by MI5. "Please try to be 1/4 way decent till I can pick up where I broke off. You are a sweetie and I love you, a little, Gwenny." He was simultaneously conducting an affair with Marie, who lived on Park Lane, and a young Yugoslavian woman from a wealthy family, Liliana Bailoni. Popov would undoubtedly be an easier agent to run if he became a little more settled in his domestic habits, sighed Wilson. He was heartily congratulated by von Kastorf for the legibility and content of his secret letters. "Your writing is wonderful. We can read every word." His business, Tarlair, was booming, although even Gisela Ashley, monitoring Popov's activities, found it hard to keep track of exactly how the company worked. "He gets particularly obscure when discussing matters of international finance," John Marriott noted. Popov's debts, large and small, trailed after him. More than $10,000 still owing to the FBI, several thousand more to MI6 in New York, several hundred dollars to the Long Island Telephone Company, and $215 to Trivett's Tested Seeds. He paid none of them. He simply forwarded the bills to MI5, along with his tailor's invoice for 18 silk shirts and a dozen monogrammed handkerchiefs.